This recording is brought to you by Whitworth University. To hear additional programs, please visit www.whitworth.edu/podcast.
Thank you, Leonard, for that lovely introduction. It's good to be home again. I left in 2009 as a retired professor here. And frankly, Linda and I have been a little scarce on campus, and so it's a delight to return back again. And I'm particularly honored that this is the Chapman, Nadine Chapman Lectures. Nadine was a colleague with Linda's, and Linda's often spoke highly of how bright and intelligent, how sensitive and how capable she was in fostering writing skills with her students, many of whom won awards. And so I feel it's a particular honor to be representative of that tradition, and a great tradition it is. I also think it's important that I acknowledge the importance of Whitworth University in the fostering of this scholarship and this research. Through both the sabbatical in 2007, I was able to actually follow the tour through the interlibrary loan system, through grants that the university helped provide me as a researcher. This was very, very important. And to invest in a fellow who was coming up on retirement is really quite extraordinary, I thought. Most cases, grants and funds go to the younger faculty, as is appropriate. As one matures and gathers experience, it's also delightful to be able to engage in a significant project. And this comes out of my passion and love for the impact that travel plays in the formation of young adults. And I'm using a window of young adults that's pretty broad. So when I did earlier work, I used the window of 11 as a beginning of kind of thinking. Up to about 29, that was the window I was wanting. And I chose figures that had left behind letters, diaries, or journals. And so I was interested in knowing the extent to which they reflected themselves about that. So when I came across John Muir's diary of his, and this was the first journal that he had written, of this 1,000-mile walk, I said, wow, this is significant. So what I'm going to do tonight is sort of explore with you and unpack what happened to him when he was a 29-year-old walking his way through the South. The mature John Muir made this statement. Everybody needs beauty as well as bread. Needs a place to play in as well as pray in. Where nature can heal, give good cheer, and strengthen body and soul. That's the mature Muir's understanding of the value of nature and why he became such a strong advocate for wild spaces, natural spaces. But he didn't start out with that perspective, although when he looks back at his own life and story of boyhood and life, he sometimes reads back into his life those sentiments. And that's what we all do when we do autobiography. We kind of distort our life in order to fit the outcome. And in some cases, Muir did that with his biographical materials. The fun thing about a journal is you get to see what the 29-year-old was writing and what he believed and what he thought about. So to that end, I had to go down to the archives and work with the archives at the Muir Papers in Stockton and work it at that level. Muir also wrote, "I only went out for a walk and finally concluded to stay out till sundown. For going out, I found, was really going in." what does it mean to go in? What was happening to him by going in? That was one of the questions that I wanted to explore. I became interested in Muir as Leonard has alluded to the fact that I had worked with college students who had gone down to Central America and had seen the transformative experience that Central America had upon their thinking, their perspective, their values. Very, very powerful. Two of my daughters went on to that program. So then I began studying historical figures, and sure enough, I found a similar kind of pattern in people like John Quincy Adams, Jane Addams, Frederick Douglass. And so when I came across this 29-year-old journal, I said, wow, there must be something in here that I could probably use to unpack what had happened to him. Before I do that, and so that's how I got interested in it. It's through Central America, as Leonard has mentioned. It was through my own daughter's experience and through then my scholarly research that I finally got into Muir. That's how I got him interested. So what can one learn from the young John Muir? What are some of the questions that we'll begin to develop? In order to do that, I think it's important to take a look very quickly at his background. He was born in 1838 in Scotland. His hometown there was Dunbar. It's not too far from Edinburgh, which is across the bay on the Firth of Forth. He then was there 11 years. His father was a merchant in Dunbar, but his father was fired with a very strong, ardent, militant, evangelical Christianity. So much so that his father insisted that John Muir memorize scripture and use combinations of bribery and beatings to accomplish that goal. So that by age 11, Muir reports in his own autobiographical materials that he had memorized three quarters of the Old Testament and could recite the entire New Testament one sitting by heart. By the way, those techniques of beatings to learn material was replicated in the Scottish school system of the day. And so the ways in which the students contended with that reality was to take it out on each other. So there were occasional thrashings among the school kids just to see if they could toughen up in the face of those kinds of beatings. I mention that detail because that regime persisted as his father made a very important decision in 1849. He was not pressed by economic needs to move to the New World. Daniel, his father, was pressed by religious fire to open up new churches and new programs in Wisconsin or wherever they would land. And he was switching careers from being a merchant to being a farmer. Now remember, John Muir is the oldest son of 11 at this stage in life. He's coming into Wisconsin, and guess who's going to do most of the work on the farm? It will be the daughters, two older daughters, and the sons that the family would produce. While the father went out on preaching tours in the countryside. So first 10 years or so, Muir and his father worked together in the fields. Thereafter, there were long absences. The father's regime, though, persisted. And he said there will be no reading of any other books other than the Bible on farm time. Farm time was from 8 o'clock in the morning till sunset, or sunrise to sunset. That was the nature of farm time. Father also was ambitious, and so what he wanted to do was to build two farms. And this is all handwork. So this meant that he was out cutting hay by hand with his sisters. It meant he was digging 300-foot wells.
Due to technical difficulties, recording was interrupted at this point of the presentation. We will now rejoin the event in progress.
It was pretty dramatic. But he also built a huge clock that was over the barn, attached to the gearing, pulling, worked out all the mechanics of it itself, so he could tell when farm time came to an end and could come into the house. Another invention he made was a hydraulic self-setting saw to use water power to run a saw so that he didn't have to use the buck saw all day long. Almost all inventions were designed to make things easy. He had a self-starting fire in the fireplace. He came up with that kind of invention as well. So Duncan suggests he go to the Wisconsin State Fair and show off these inventions, which he did. He asked his father for money. Father said no. And he took out some coins that his grandfather had given him way back in 1849. He'd saved a little bit of money himself for some of his own produce, bought the train ticket, and said, I'm going to show my inventions at the state fair. And then proceeded to convince the conductor, after he loaded his bag of inventions in the luggage car, if he could ride on the cowcatcher going up into Madison, Wisconsin, which he did. So you have this wonderful image of Muir on the front of the cowcatcher. He's got a beard now, wind whistling through his beard and hair, going all on up to Madison, Wisconsin, to show his invention at the state fair. That proved to be a very life-shaping experience for him, because when he showed the inventions, two of the children happened to be the children of Jean C. Carr, who was the wife of the professor of chemistry at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and she was part of the committee. She immediately took a liking to John Muir's inventiveness, his characteristics. The reputation had grown. There were newspaper articles about this wondrous person from Portage, Wisconsin. And Jean Carr talked with other professors at Wisconsin and said, can anything be done to bring Muir to Wisconsin? And sure enough, some things were done. And he got some scholarship money together. So in 1861, he entered for just a couple of years at the University of Wisconsin. There he took coursework in chemistry, geology, and then he learned from a classmate about botany. One day he was walking with Milton Griswold, and Milton had this extraordinary book with him. It's called Wood's Class Book in Botany. I've seen the actual copy of this, really quite hefty and quite large. And Griswold said, you see that locust tree up there? And Muir said, well, yes, I see it. Do you realize that's the same kind of plant as this pea vine down here? And Muir was dumbfounded. He said, Griswold, that's amazing. That's incredible. I'm going to go out and buy me a class book in botany, and we'll go all over the Wisconsin prairies botanizing together. His room was just full of plants. When he and Jean Carr were talking to one another, he was a babysitter for the Carr children, they were talking about plants. It was a genuine enthusiasm. He discovered a passion in nature and had kind of a spiritual component to it as well. That has to be pointed out. So, in any event, if you take a look at those dates, you'll recognize that in 1860, 1861, 62, 63 were Civil War years. And so a lot of the people were enlisting who were in colleges and universities in those days, going off to war. John Muir was of a Disciples of Christ heritage, had not actually naturalized an American citizen. But he went home in 1863 to submit himself to the draft. The draft didn't get him. His brother, in the meantime, had gone up to Canada. And so he followed his brother to do work in Canada. And in Canada, he was working primarily on a factory that made broomsticks. It was kind of a small family-run factory. But he was also taking his passion in botany with him, because he was mucking around the swamps of Upper Canada, and he was looking for one particular orchid. The orchid was called the Hider of the North, the Calypso borealis. And to get some understanding of Muir's passion for flowers and nature, one has to see his experience there. When he had this encounter, this direct encounter with this isolated, lovely orchid on a darkened bank in the middle of that swampland in there, He fell down on his knees and he wept. And then he wrote a long letter to Jean Carr describing his experience of seeing this marvelous, marvelous flower. Carr had the letter on her desk. Another professor came in, read the letter, said, whoa, this is strong writing. And then wove it into an article he published in the Boston Recorder. This was Muir's first published article, but without any attribution to John Muir. Jean Carr was furious with the professor who sort of cribbed the material and wove it into his own work. In any event, He was up in Wisconsin between 1863 and 1866. There are a number of things he did in the Wisconsin, up in Canada. He improved the manufacturing capabilities of that factory. He was offered a partnership. He improved the mechanization of the making of the broomsticks. They had a huge inventory of broomsticks. They were ready to put out on the market. And then the factory burned down. And so this Disciples of Christ community owed him money, but they couldn't pay. The inventory was gone, and Muir had to find work elsewhere. So he went down to Indianapolis, and he went to work for a wagon wheel factory. And that was in 1866. He returned to Indianapolis. He had some contacts in Indianapolis there. And then shortly after a time in Indianapolis, he was trying to figure out what to do. On one side was his love of botany and nature. On the other side was his evident success in manufacturing, in invention, and in factory management. The number of things he did there really predated Frederick Taylor's work in efficient management production. He used waste, for example, in the boiler to cut down on expenses. He made the machines run far more efficiently. He was very good at that kind of work. But he also was restless, and this is where I get the title from the book. Let me read to you a couple letters from Muir at this stage of his life. He writes to his brother in May of 1866, "I have made up my mind it's impossible for me to escape from mechanics. I begin to see and feel that I have some talent for invention. And I just think I'll turn all my attention that way at once." So he's matter of fact with his brother. To his sister, he writes, "I feel something within, some restless fires that urge me in a way very different from my real wishes." He's drawing a distinction here between what his real wishes are and what he's good at. "And I suppose I'm doomed to live in some of these noisy commercial centers." I'm doomed to live. What happens when a young adult is on the cusp of being really good at something but not liking it, on one hand, and having passion about something else, but there's no apparent reward? How do you resolve that tension? In Muir's case, it was an eye accident. One night he was working on a lacing strapped around a gear system. They used belts in those days. He had to loosen up the lacing in order to realign the gearing. He took the pointed end of a file, pulled down on against the wheel itself. It slipped, sprang up, and hit his eye. It poked through his eye, a part in the front part of it. Ocular fluid dropped down into his hand. And he went blind in that eye. The other eye went out with sympathetic blindness. And if you read through his letters during that period of time, it is despair. He says, "I am lost. I am lost. I'll never, ever see God's beauty again." So from that point on, after that happened, he didn't know quite where he was going to do. He would never be able to botanize again. It took about 5 weeks of laying down in a darkened room. Letters came pouring in from his mentors up in Madison. Children began reading books to him who were part of his Sunday school program. Gradually his eyesight returned. And it was that event that then forced the decision in John Muir's own mind. He wouldn't let the opportunity slip away again. As he recaptured his eyesight, he said, "I'm through with human inventions. I want to go out and see God's inventions." And that's how he put it. Therefore, he then made a plan to take a walk, a 1,000-mile walk through the South. So that's all the background, and it became, in fact, a forced choice. This is a picture of Muir in 1863 while he's finishing up the Wisconsin. The thing I like about this is it's very classic Victorian propriety that's evident here. Everything from the pillar in the background to the Gothic ruins and so forth. It's just a sort of classic formality. And keep this image in mind as we move along here. This is Muir's thousand-mile walk. It began on the 1st of September, 1867. He took the train from Indianapolis to Jeffersonville, crossed by ferry to Louisville, and walked through the city of Louisville, he said, without speaking to anybody. And then laid out his maps and made a southern route through the south, which led through these towns and villages you see along the way. In his autobiography, which was published after his death by his editor, he writes, "I went the wildest and leafiest way possible." Well, that's hyperbole, because basically he followed roads. Going from Louisville to Elizabethtown, Munfordville, hitting all the county seats, down to Horse Cave, Mammoth Cave, Glasgow Junction, then through central Tennessee, moving to the east, Jamestown, Montgomery, Kingston, which is on the Clinch and Tennessee River, Philadelphia, Madisonville, then in Murphy, North Carolina. Then he dropped down into Georgia, Blairsville, Gainesville, Athens, Thompson, Augusta, then Savannah, and then took a ship from Savannah down to Fernandina, and then followed a railroad track from Fernandina to Gainesville. His original plan was a three-year sabbatical. First year or so to make this walk through the south. The second would be to travel to the Orinoco River, following Alexander von Humboldt, go up the Orinoco River to the headwaters of the Amazon, then take the Amazon all the way out to the Atlantic Ocean, then hop on a boat there, go to Africa, and then go up the Congo. That was his three-year plan. I'll have to say, I thank God he didn't make it. He would have died in Africa like Mungo Park did, perhaps. Who knows? But in any event, that was his plan. He was doing about 18 to 20 miles a day. Small towns and villages, went through about 23, 24 of them. He encountered all kinds of folks, African-Americans, poor people, rich planters, and had wonderful conversations that we see through his diary and journal. One of the things that should also be pointed out is that this southern walk was the first mountains that John Muir ever saw, in the Cumberlands and in the Smokies. He'd never seen a mountain stream before. He'd never seen mountains before. And he was just overwhelmed by the beauty of these mountains in the south. On the Smoky Mountains, he writes, "The scenery is far grander than any I ever before beheld. It's an ocean of wood and has swelling mountain beauty." And then he described it as follows. "All were united by curves and slopes of inimitable softness and beauty. Oh, these forest gardens of our father, what perfection, what divinity in their architecture. What simplicity and mysterious complexity and detail. Who shall read the teaching of these sylvan pages? The glad brotherhood of rills that sing in the valleys and the happy creatures that dwell in them under the tender keeping of a father's care." So it's very clear that Muir was struck by the beauty of the South in some profound sorts of ways. But it's also important that he received some challenges. And one of these challenges took place in the Tennessee Mountains, up probably just on the cusp of the Hiawassee River, just south of Madisonville before he got into Murphy. It should be pointed out that this is 1867, 2 years after the end of the Civil War. So in East Tennessee, he's seen a lot of war devastation. He's seen broken down fences. He's seen emptied out homes. Whole counties have been depopulated. And he said he could see the devastation of war on people's faces. There's a lot of suspicion to northerners and outsiders up in Tennessee. Muir came upon a blacksmith. And let me read to you then a portion that I've included of this encounter with the blacksmith. The blacksmith is working his anvil, bare-chested, sweaty, begrimed, and covered with shaggy black hair. Though he needed food and lodging, Muir had nothing smaller than a $5 bill. And locals had barely any cash to break that bill for him. Initially walking away from Muir's request, the blacksmith changed his mind. He said to his wife, "Tell him to go in the house. A man that comes out right like that beforehand is welcome to eat my bread." So even though there'd be no pay for room and board, the man expressed hospitality. The simple dinner of cornbread and bacon began with a blessing. At dinner, the couple described the terrible times of war and followed this with hunting stories. Looking at Muir's plant press, the blacksmith was, quote, puzzled with my real character of my journey. He challenged Muir, young man, what are you doing down here? Muir recorded the exchange in his journal. I replied that I was looking at plants. Plants? What kinds of plants? Oh, all kinds, grass, weeds, flowers, trees, mosses, ferns, almost everything that grows is interesting to me. Well, young man, you mean to say you're not employed by the government or some private business? No, I'm not employed by anyone except myself. I love all kinds of plants, and I came down here to these southern states to get acquainted with as many of them as possible. More questions followed, underscoring the blacksmith's skepticism regarding Muir's work. It seems very strange, sir, that you should come so far into these rough mountains just for weeds and blossoms. Fond of debate, the blacksmith challenged Muir's purposes and plans. Muir reported that the blacksmith marshaled a long, ugly regiment of musty, orthodox arguments against wasting useful time. Blacksmith said pointedly, you look like a strong-minded man, and surely you're able to do something better than wander over the country and look at weeds and blossoms. These are hard times, and real work is required of every man that is able. Picking up blossoms doesn't seem to be a man's work at all in any kind of times. Remembering the blacksmith's blessing, Muir asked, you're a believer in the Bible, are you not? Oh, yes. Using memorized texts from the Bible, Muir pointed out that Solomon had studied and collected plants, including the cedars of Lebanon and the hyssop that grew in the cracks of walls. He said that Solomon walked the mountains of Judea to see every plant. Even Jesus referred to the flowers, urging his disciples to consider the lilies, how they grow. And comparing their beauty with Solomon in all his glory. Driving his point home, Muir asked, now, whose advice am I to take? Yours or Christ's? Christ says, consider the lilies. You say, don't consider them. It isn't worthwhile for any strong-minded man. The man's position fell away in the face of Muir's arguments. He had never thought of blossoms quite that way before. So, clearly there was this challenge that he experienced, but there was another sets of challenges that he experienced as he moved his way southward. And here I'll go through just a few slides to give you an idea. In 2007, Linda and I, on the first part of this trip, basically followed Muir's route, and so some of these slides are from my 2007 journey. This is Jeffersonville, right at the Ohio River. Today there's a bridge that, in his day, there was a ferry that led him across into Louisville. This is a copy or example of his journal. And it illustrates his handwriting. These are in the archives of the John Muir Papers of Holt Atherton. And I love that sort of dedication to himself and his work in the upper, on the left-hand side in the upper corner there. It simply says, John Muir, Earth, Planet, Universe. He's not caught up in Civil War politics. He's caught up in something bigger than the Civil War. And more interesting. And he has greater dedication about. So we'll take a look at what that was. He also did sketches of himself. So in his journal, he writes out this little sketch. And here he is with his wool clothing and... His plant press is off back to the side, and he's laying out his maps outside of Louisville for his southern route. remember, he always puts himself in with little beards in there. Kentucky, when he went through, was a very welcoming experience for him. And so here he refers to the oak trees with his big white arms walking him down the roadway. He's amazed at the Salt River. These are examples of the Kentucky knobs and woodland sunflowers, which he began to gather and collect. And Kentucky acknowledges the presence of John Muir with his John Muir Highway, which follows his route southward. through Kentucky, and these are some of the flowers along the way. And then he comes up to the Tennessee and its mountains, the first mountains he's ever seen. And by the way, this journal talks about how hard it is to climb a sustained climb. He'd been through the Dells and the Highlands of Scotland. He said there was nothing like that, but it was really hard climbing on the Cumberlands and the Unakas. The other thing he loved was this particular mountain stream. It's called the Hiawassee. This has unusual flint uplifts, which allow the water to dance across the surface, and it gems and sparkles in amazing sorts of ways. And he was absolutely enchanted with this beauty. And one of the things about his enchantment is he always showed gratitude when he discovered something that he had never seen before or something that was unusual. And let me describe at least one passage that comes from his journal where he encounters that kind of beauty. He described the Emory River as luxuriantly peopled with rare and lovely flowers. Every plant and movement of the stream seemed solemnly to feel the presence of the great Creator. Muir wrote that he lingered in this sanctuary a long time, thanking the Lord with all my heart for his goodness and allowing me to enter and enjoy it. You know, that's a thread I found he repeated over and over and over again in this journal, this thread of gratitude. I've done a little bit of background research on the role of gratitude, and it really is a virtue of resilience. It allows a person to meet obstacles, difficulties, and setbacks in a far healthier sort of way than if you start counting up all your complaints. So from my perspective, one of the things I'm seeing in his journal is this this expression of what I call a character of resilience, the ability to give thanks for something bigger than yourself. As we move forward to consider then, he moves down into Georgia and went past Mount Yona in Georgia through this territory, and he came across some very different kinds of plants in the south. Beautiful plants like this Jack in the Pulpit, which I picture I took when I was at the Smith Gall Woods in northern Georgia. And then he came to Athens. He said this is the only southern town he would like to come back and revisit. because it reminded so much of Madison, I think, being a university town and so forth. He was amazed by the longleaf pine, which he saw on the journey. And in Savannah, he was enthralled with the large live oak trees. he was running out of money now. He had $3 when he came into Savannah. There was no lodging available for him. So he walked 5 miles out and would come back 5 miles into the city every day to the Adams Express office, waiting for money to be sent by his brother, Daniel, who was receiving it from the party up in Canada. And I think, frankly, the people at the Adams Express office were trying to stiff him. And he eventually had an exchange where he said, yes, I can prove I'm John Muir. Why? Because the letter says that John Muir is knowledgeable about botany. And you can examine me on botany if you don't think I'm John Muir, that I just stole it from a John Muir. The man went in to see his supervisor and said, I'll give him the money. So the first thing he did was go out and buy some gingerbread and stuff it in his mouth. He was so hungry. But in Savannah, he had to live in this place. It was St. Bonaventure Cemetery for about 5 days, waiting for money to come and go into this area. It's an enchanting place to this day. For those of you who've been to Savannah, you probably know that this is the place where Johnny Mercer is buried. Or you probably recognize it as the place that's featured in the book called The Midnight of Garden of Good and Evil. Okay? Savannah is a city of eccentrics of sorts. He found it troublesome and difficult to live in downtown Savannah, so he lived here among the tombs. And he camped out here. And here's his little encampment. It's a little wiki up over here. And see the tombs off to the left and see the bugs around his head. Now, the cemetery was referred to by people and culture as an abode of the dead. And it was a place of glooms and fear. And so Muir, in many respects, felt that it was very important to think about that. He wrote out a very quick entry in his journal. But then if you take a closer look at the journal, you see additional entries and other entries at various points of time. This became a very important place for him. And why? Because probably at St. Bonaventure, he was bit by a mosquito. And by the time he got into Florida, especially at Cedar Key, he had come down with malaria. And so in the process of recuperating from malaria, he came back to rewrite Bonaventure section, which grapples with the issue of death. Because Muir acknowledges in his own, what he calls, a death chart, 100% you're dead, okay? 20% you're pretty lively. Muir charted himself as close to 80% dead by the time he was in Cedar Key. And so while recuperating in Cedar Key, he came back over this chapter again, over and over again. Here's his position. Civilization, he says, teaches young people to fear death by all the ceremonies surrounding it. But take a look at what's going on in St. Bonaventure. Screaming eagles off in the distance, soft winds blowing through the Talansia, vines growing up over the tombstones, rain eroding the inscriptions on the tombstones. What's happening here? Nature is trumping death. It's not a place, an abode of the dead. This place is an abode of life, if you have the wits to see it. Now, if you put the human person at the center of the universe, yeah, it's sad. But if you put nature at the center of the universe, it's a place of glad rejoicings. So that's his perspective about what he learned in coming to terms with the nature of death. By the way, he called that mingling of life and death in the cemetery, quote, a divine harmony, unquote, where things are kind of linked together. And this would lead to a further thought of his later on. This is the Fernandina, Florida. These are the railroad tracks he followed. This is the safest way to get through the swamps of Florida in the north. Still, he was collecting flowers, and he would plunge through the swamps adjacent to the side of this railroad bed to gather a flower or two. And he was very fearful some of the predatory animals that were there, especially the alligators. But he also, as a young man, had dreamed of this plant. He writes, I dreamed of palm trees that I'd read in Milton's Paradise Lost, which, by the way, was a book that he brought with him on the journey. He didn't pay too much attention to the second part of the poem, but he loved the creation center part of the poem, where Milton describes the crisp brooks and the palm trees. He'd also read the Testament, so he wanted to see a palm tree. And as he saw this palm tree, he drew this salutation of the palm tree, man with plant press. And he used Milton's language to describe it. First of all, there was a corona of glory around the outside of the palm tree as light glinted off the fronds. It's radiant, okay? The second thing he observed about it is a wave in the wind, and he called that a, quote, a sign of worship. So the palm tree for him was just a pregnant symbol full of God's eminence, God's presence in that palm tree, the thing itself, okay? That's on the positive side. What do you do about these? His father had taught, being influenced by what I call dominion theology or garden theology, that predatory animals like bears, wolves, coyotes, foxes that are outside the fence are the devil. They're satanic. And it's our right as human beings to get rid of them. And so we can exterminate wolves and coyotes and bears and even alligators, according to his father's perspective. Now, Muir was worried about these because every time he walked into those swamps and put his foot on a log, he wondered if it would be one that would snap him. So he wrote out this little sketch. If you observe the sketch closely, which I have, there you see two lovely alligators, and in the mouth of one of them is a human being. And what I'd like to sort of share with you at this point is this. He says, I think most of the antipathies which haunt and terrify us are morbid productions of ignorance and weakness. I have better thoughts of these alligators now that I've seen them at home. Honorable representatives of the great saurian of an older creation, may you long enjoy your lilies and rushes and be blessed now and then with a mouthful of terror-stricken man by way of dainty. And later on in the journal, he writes, God hears the prayers and the petitions of the alligator for food. Wow, what's going on here? There's a transformation taking place in Muir's writing. He's shifting away from what we would call an anthropocentric view of the universe, where human beings stand at the top of the created order with the right to decide what's a useful plant and what's a useless plant, what's a domesticated animal and what is a predatory animal. Muir believes that that's a function of spiritual arrogance. And the word he used to describe people who believe they have rights over all of creation, or another way of looking at it, the universe exists as a cosmos to meet our human interests and needs, is arrogant. It's spiritually arrogant. And he makes a very profound insight that all of creation has its rights to exist, including the alligator. So he is tackling firsthand this whole apparatus of dominion theology and garden theology and saying, we need to be in wild spaces for great moral purposes. Why do we need that? We need it to teach us humility about our finiteness, our limitations, and restraint. Sure, we belong in the universe, but we don't belong in a way that commands the universe to exist for our interests alone. That person, he says, is a person who thinks they're a lord over creation. Wow, that's a pretty radical and significant thought. So John Muir's worldview was a shift from an anthropocentric to a biocentric perspective. He asserted the rights of creation in contrast to the interests of Lord Man. He shifts from the garden theology to the moral reason why we need wild spaces to teach us humility and restraint. The human project is finite. Let me quote. Now, it never seems to occur to these far-seeing teachers that nature's object in making animals and plants might possibly be, first of all, the happiness of each one of them, not the creation of all for the happiness of one. Why should man value himself as more than a small part of one great unit of creation? And what creature of all that the Lord has taken pains to make is not essential to the completeness of the unit, the cosmos? The universe would be incomplete without man, but it would also be incomplete without the smallest transmicroscopic creature that dwells beyond our conceitful eyes and knowledge. This star, our own good earth, made many a successful journey around the heavens ere man was made, and whole kingdoms of creatures enjoyed existence and returned to dust ere man appeared to claim them. After human beings have also played their part in creation's plan, they too may disappear without any general burning or extraordinary commotion whatever. So what I've discovered in this journal is a transformation of a worldview. It's shifted from this dominion, garden, anthropocentric perspective to an entirely different understanding. And why Muir was so passionate that human beings living in cities should engage wild spaces. It was for their own spiritual improvement, in effect. So I recognize the limitations of talks and articles and books about nature. So I'd like to finish this with this observation in conclusion. Muir himself wrote this. Books and talks and articles about nature are at least little more than advertisements, hurrah invitations, dinner bells. Nothing can take the place of absolute contact, of seeing and feeding at God's table for oneself. The cold and perishing cannot be warmed by descriptions of fire and sunshine, nor the hungry fed with books about bread. The Lord himself must anoint eyes to see. My pen cannot. One can only see by loving. Love makes things visible and all labor light. Nobody can be ambitious to do anything wonderful when God's wonders are in sight. Every day we should all pray, O Lord, open thou mine eyes. Thanks for your questions.